It is the Brent Winterbull Show, News Talk 1110 and 99.3 WBT. Welcome to the program. It is great to be here with you. In an hour, a little bit less than an hour, President of the United States Joseph Robinette Biden will come before the loving, applauding reporters to answer questions. They call it a press conference. By my count, we haven't had like an official shindig like this for 300 days. It's been a really long time since he actually addressed the press in a formal press conference. We will see what the questions are like. We will find out a number of things. First of all, we're going to find out who it was that they instructed to ask questions of him, what it is he has to say about a number of things, and we will play it live. We're going to be sitting here letting you listen to it live so that you can take it all in. And I imagine at this point, with tomorrow being the one-year anniversary of the presidency of Joe Biden, you know, there are a number of questions that are out there on the table, right? What the biggest disappointment, the biggest surprise from this administration has been? Biggest scandal of his administration? Afghanistan, COVID-19, economy, border, crime, supply chain, inflation. I mean, what are you looking at in terms of that with an eye toward tomorrow? And then, of course, if you were at the press conference, if you were at the formal press conference, what question would you ask? And you know, if you're going to ask him a question, make sure it's not like, when are you going to resign? Like that doesn't go a lot of places. But is there an issue, a topic that you would ask him about in his role as the president of the United States? 704-570-1110. One of the things that I think is interesting is how much America has been transformed in a year. And some of it is actually not for bad. And I want to start with some good news kind of stories, okay? A record number of Americans are quitting their jobs as part of the Great Resignation. And in a lot of cases, they're starting their own businesses. Any number of reasons explain why people will quit their jobs to go solo or form companies. But a few stand out. The first is the control and the autonomy that comes with being your own boss. Being in control of your work and your time is a compelling motivation to pursue an entrepreneurial journey. While an entrepreneur still has people to answer to, clients, customers, investors, self-employment is a way to get out from underneath a boss's thumb and do your own thing. Second, if you decide you're going to go out there and strike out on your own, the ability to pursue a job with meaning and purpose. Meaning is deeply personal and inwardly focused. And research that's out there has shown that the meaning behind the work is more motivating than any other aspect of work, including pay and rewards, or opportunities for promotion or working conditions. And then finally, there's this element. Purpose is how one's personal meaning is expressed outward into society, or how one's job is making a difference in the world. A McKinsey study found that the uncertainties caused by the pandemic's response have turned people's attention toward more purposeful work. Those who find it are better for it, with those who say they are living their purpose at work reporting 5 times greater levels of well-being compared to those who are not. But I want to go back to the very first point, because I think this is a hugely important thing to discuss. Any number of reasons explain why people quit their jobs to go solo or form companies. But a few stand out, right? Control, autonomy, be your own boss, being in control of your work, etc. I'm wondering, given the fact that many of these people are not at the front end of their careers, but at the midpoint of their careers or later in their careers, I'm wondering how much of this is associated with the changing nature of corporations. I'm old enough to remember, and I'm not that old, but I'm old enough to remember when I didn't know what the politics of a company was. I didn't know what the politics of Walmart was. I didn't know what the politics of a supermarket chain was. I didn't know what the politics of a bookstore was. I just went and bought books at the mall or at the store. I went and I shopped at the places I went and I shopped at. I really didn't know what the politics of those organizations were. But increasingly, what have we seen? We've seen this morphing, and I don't think it's for the good. I think it's for the bad. We've seen this morphing of what we talked about yesterday with ESG, right? With the environmental and social governance. We've seen woke corporations taking root, and not just woke corporations in places where you'd expect, right? Where the beta boys and beta girls in Silicon Valley, you know, want to sit around and mope all day. We see it actually in regular life, in normal regular life, right? We see it out with a business here and a business there, and you're seeing that increasingly. You're also seeing increasingly the increase in tyranny being run through businesses, airlines, right? Forcing you to wear masks if you want to get on the plane and wear a certain kind of mask if you want to get on the plane. Companies telling you, you must wear this kind of mask. You must not do this. You must not do that. You must test. You must get vaccinated. You must do all these things. And so I think what's happening, why people are saying, you know what, I'm about ready to get out of this line of work, is because they're sick and tired of what corporations have become. I think they're looking at this fundamental transformation of the American economy under Joseph Robinette Biden. I think they're looking at this and they're going, you know what? Yeah, I don't want to work for Apple. I don't want to work for Zuckerberg. I don't want to work for Zucker at CNN. I don't want to work for these ideologues that masquerade as CEOs. I want to determine who it is I do business with. And if I don't much like your politics, or I don't much like your values, or I don't much like what it is you're up to, it's my business. My name is on the side of the building, and I'm going to chart my own course. I do think it's the hammer of the vaccines and the hammer of the masking and the hammering and the hammering and the hammering at the corporate level that is driving a lot of people to decide to go out and do their own thing. I do think that's a huge part of it. In addition, many people are fleeing dying and failing blue cities, heading out to greener pastures because they learned something while they were working for those corporations for the last three glorious years under the Fauci pandemic. They learned that you could do Zoom and you could do work anywhere in the world. You don't have to be sitting in a failing, dying, dangerous, overrun big city. News Talk 1110, 99.3 WBT. It is the Brett Winterbull Show. We're awaiting the kickoff of the Biden press conference. And the reason why people are making such a big deal about this is because it's so seldom that he has them. So we will continue to monitor, watch, look, keep you apprised. We will be playing decent portions of this, just FYI. We will be letting you hear directly from the President of the United States. But I want to jump out and talk to Stephen, who's reacting to what we were talking about in the beginning of the show about people who are starting their own businesses and heading on out to do their own thing. Stephen, welcome to the program. Thanks for checking in today.
How are you doing today?
I'm well, thank you.
So I would just like to say I work for a number of companies, and a lot of my bosses, supervisors would say you'd make a great CEO, but the way you present things, you'll never get there. You know, I wasn't politically correct. Mm-hmm. I didn't navigate through, you know, the chain of command, so to say. And I said, well, hell with it. Started my own business, did it for 20 years, and now retiring.
Wow. Retiring.
Well, and what I found is that I think part of the problem with businesses is that people in management, it's the true Peter principle, mm-hmm. get promoted to a level of incompetence, and then you're so damn scared you don't do anything. You don't want to rock the boat. You don't want to make any changes because, you know, you don't want to piss somebody off and lose your job.
Right.
And I saw that many a times. Big company moved, closed a lot of offices, moved to Charlotte, had their corporate headquarters here, hired a lot of people from other companies into positions in this big office. And when the head of the office would ask for ideas on how to improve customer service, because this company was a service oriented and they sucked for customer service, all he would listen to is the people from his company, even though he had people from other companies with higher ratings. And I said, you know, I raised my hand and said, you keep doing what you're doing, you're not going to change. I said, you need to entertain different ideas. Oh, it pissed him off so damn bad. It wasn't even funny.
Well, let me ask you a question about this, Stephen. I appreciate you calling in the show. When you took that leap, when you went for it on your own, how did you feel the first time you took that step out on your own?
Well, you know, luckily, you know, I married up. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to really sweat that I'm going to starve, you know, but my personality is such that regardless of that, I started off slow. I worked my way up, built more clientele, bought more equipment. And so many people, particularly from up north, will come down here and say, well, how can I be successful? You know, you were successful and, you know, you've been doing it for so long. What do I need to do? I said two things. Answer your phone and show up to your appointments on time.
Right.
Simple. And that's all you got to do because, you know, we're back to the point where we were when everything was gangbusters. You had service companies. They didn't care if they pissed you off because there was 20 other people wanting them to do the work.
Right.
So they didn't care.
Right.
But when the things hit the tank, all those businesses were gone. And the only one who survived were the people who had the good reputation.
Yeah.
And that's we're back to that now because there is no customer service anymore. I don't care what it is. Yeah. Nobody cares, and their supervisors, their bosses, and the corporation doesn't care.
No, I get it. I get it. Look, it's great stuff, Stephen. I appreciate you checking in with us, and I'm happy you shared your story. So the number of Americans that actually filed paperwork to start businesses hit a record of 5.4 million in 2021, up from the previous record of 4.4 million in 2020. All right? So the geographical areas, according, there's a piece over at Marketplace, and they're referencing a study by LendingTree, looked into the geographic areas where entrepreneurship is booming the most, and they found Memphis, Tennessee is the top of the list, closely followed by other southern cities, Mobile, and Shreveport, Louisiana. Now, knowing this, knowing about this explosion of people going out and starting their own businesses, what in the heck is the administration doing pushing dependency and taking checks from the government? Like, you have to be able to read the room. You have to be able to understand what it is people are clamoring for. What they're clamoring for is not checks coming in from the government. They want to go pursue their opportunity. And they don't want to see crime everywhere. And they want to see options. And they want to see all of this stuff. Nobody wants free community college. Nobody wants to get a check from the government. What everybody wants is a chance to do their own thing. You have incredible people in this country. And one political party wants to sell the notion that they're victims. You've been ripped off. You can't do it because your race. You can't do it because your ethnicity. You can't do it because your sexual orientation. You can't do it because you're LGBTQ+. You can't do it because of all these extenuating circumstances that you can't control, except that people are doing it. It's kind of interesting, right? We do have the fire in the belly. It's just the politicians trying to put that fire out and make us dependent on their money. News Talk 1110, 99.3 WBT. It's the Brett Whatever Show. So, turning our attention to the current challenges that we're facing in the country right now, right? What are we hearing about? We're hearing about homelessness and housing and the lack of housing and all that sort of stuff. Now, I don't know how much of this we're going to hear from the president or from anybody else because they seem to be singularly fixated on what they're calling the voting rights bills, which is really, that is a way oversimplification for this. This is a nationalization of voting in the country, taking the power out of the House, out of the state houses and out of the states in this country, and instead putting it in the hands of Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. And every time I see President Biden come out and complain about who gets to count the votes, who counts the votes, who says the votes, who picks the votes, I want to say to them, well, Nancy Pelosi's not somebody you want to be counting the votes. Chuck Schumer, you don't want to be counting the votes. My gosh, that's no way to run this operation. But that's what they're talking about in Washington. They're talking about things that are not connected to you, right? You think about housing. You think about affordable housing. You think about, okay, where is it that I can live, that I can send my kids to a good school? They can have great opportunities. All that sort of stuff is hugely important, no doubt. But where are we going to get these places? Well, get a load of this idea. You know how you've got these politicians in cities around our country desperate to expand affordable housing. Do you know that in New York, A billion square feet of New York office space was turned into apartments. Look at Uptown here. Look at these tall buildings in Uptown. How many of them are totally full? How many of them are not totally full? A substantial number of them are not totally full. One Wall Street, which is an address in New York, provides a timely model for converting empty office buildings into residential units. The question is how to create affordable, adaptive, reuse housing that just won't cater to the elite. What they're talking about is taking these skyscrapers, some of which are only occupied by 28% of the workforce that was once in those buildings, and converting these huge buildings, these huge skyscrapers, into affordable housing. Look, they note, the pandemic has changed how and how often we use offices. Companies all over the U.S. have been reducing their office footprints or shuttering offices altogether. And cities are now weighing whether to convert empty office buildings into housing. One Wall Street offers a timely, if expensive, model for this. And while that model may only apply to luxury living, it makes a solid case for adapted reuse in buildings around the country. I mean, what do we know is going to happen with this administration? Because they said it when they were running for office. They want to push the metros further and further into the suburbs. They want the metros and the suburbs to kind of morph into one thing. Well, the problem with suburbs is housing is much more expensive. Why? Because it's much more scarce. People have poured into suburbs around big cities around this country for the better part of the last 50, 60, 70 years. So where are you supposed to live in a place where you can afford? Well, you actually could live in a city if you were using repurposed office space for housing. Oh, that doesn't make any sense. Why wouldn't it make any sense? You've got electricity, you've got water lines, you've got sewer lines. Those are built for office complexes, which means they're accustomed to being utilized by dozens or hundreds of workers on a floor, on a series of floors. Why couldn't that possibly bear out as a living space? And wouldn't that be great? Think of all of the malls, all of the places that have been shut down because of the pandemic, because of Fauci's pandemic. Look at what's happened. You've seen malls go under. You've seen businesses facing difficulties. You've seen, obviously, people moving out of cities. Well, what do you say? You bring them back into the cities and you say, listen, we're going to house you in the skyscrapers. We're going to house you in the converted malls. We're going to house you in all these different other facilities where now you can have a condo. You could have a condo and a view. It's a lot easier to secure a big skyscraper from the front door up than it is securing a neighborhood. You don't have to worry about the defunding of the police because all you need is one person to work as a guard at the front door. Show me your ID. You can go upstairs. Do you live here? Who are you here to see? We'll announce your visit, what have you. That's all you need. Forget about the defunding of the police. You don't need that many cops, right? But yet nobody is pushing this idea. Why is nobody pushing this idea? Why is that? I mean, you could put things inside these buildings. You could put the entire bottom floor. Could be supermarkets. Could be shopping retail centers. And then you could have a gym in the building. You could have gyms in the building. You could have Jim from San Diego in the building if you wanted him. Hi, Brett. I mean, you could do any of the things you want like that and repurpose all this stuff. Have we learned nothing from the reuse and recycle mentality that AOC has brought to us as a nation? I would think that we would be in favor of recycling space, but no, nobody's floating that idea. Why? The landlords, people that own those buildings, I'm sure they don't want to have empty units. They don't want to have the notes called. They don't want to have any of that stuff. So what do you say we repurpose it? Right here in Uptown. Right in Midtown Manhattan. Right in Los Angeles, California, all the places that could be vibrant again with people moving in. All you got to do is make it happen. It's not impossible. Again, this is about climate. This is about climate change. This is about reuse. This is about all this sort of stuff, repurpose. That's a hugely important thing. You could even put, here, try this for size. Ready? If you had a tall enough building, you could have a retail establishment downstairs. You could have gyms and salons and things like that on the lower floors. Then you get up to like the 15th to 20th floor. You put your schools in the building, right? You got your schools in the building. And then, you know, floors 15 to 25, what do you got? Those are all residential units for the people that go to the school. You don't even have to go to a neighborhood school. You can go to a school that's in your building. Think about how great that would be. You'd see your teachers after hours, in the elevator, you'd see the coach, you'd see the jock, you'd see all your friends from school, especially high school. It'd be a great way to get together. You could literally turn each of these skyscrapers into its own community with a school. Where do you go to school? 1225 State Street. That's the school I go to. Where do you live? 1225 State Street. We don't have to own a car anymore. We're decarbonizing. Why doesn't anybody want to get behind that? Someone tell Biden. He should pitch that.
1110-993 WBT. Okay, final phenomenon that I'm going to share with you, okay, because we've done some different phenomenons this hour. We've talked about entrepreneurship. We talked to somebody who started a business, took that risk, and I applaud them for that. We took a look at what it was that drove people to start their own businesses. We just talked about how it is they're trying to repurpose living in cities, right, to put housing units into old office buildings that are not getting used anymore because of the pandemic. How about this one, though? Raise your hand if you like this idea. Hot desking. Have you heard of hot desking? Hot desking. Okay, it goes like this. You know, there's really only like 30% of the workforce is in the office at any given time. Why do you have 100 desks? So just find a desk you sit at when you come into work and just deal with it. You know, I mean, it's really nobody's desk. It's not your desk. You're just sitting there for the day. You log on to the computer. You do your work. I mean, who cares, really? Hot desking is the practice of booking random desks each time an employee works in the office. It's one of the most popular hybrid work-related changes that employers are embracing over the last 2 years. So they're just saying, listen, we don't need all these offices. We just need a big room, and then you just go sit wherever, go sit over there and sign in, log in, and do your thing. Now, is it efficient? Sure. Sure it is. Is it comfortable? Probably not. Probably not. Look, I come in every day to the studio that I broadcast from. When I'm broadcasting from here, I come in, I sit down in this exact same spot, and I do the show from this exact same spot. It's not my spot. It's a spot that's used by the on-air hosts that are here. TJ and Josh are here. They're working in the studio as well, right 2 feet from me, and they're using the board that they use every single day and all that. But they don't sit in here for 8 hours. I don't sit in here for 8 hours. This is what you do. Now, here's the thing about this hot desking idea. The hot desking idea is why I think people are starting to say, yeah, I think I'm just going to go be an entrepreneur. I think I'm just going to go be my own person. I think I'm just going to get out of this rat race because this just is starting to feel like it's really impersonal. I like coming in and sitting at my desk where I have my sports tchotchke and a picture of my loved ones. And I purposely left a thing of Mentos in that drawer for if I want to have a quick snack or I got some stinky breath, whatever it is. I like that. But I don't know what's in this drawer, and I don't want to look at what's in this drawer, and I don't know who's in here. And we're living in the era of COVID, and I don't want to catch it. I don't want to use somebody else's keyboard. But this is what companies are now doing. This is the Globe and Mail reporting this out, and there are people who don't like it. There are people who don't like it. The concept has gained mainstream popularity in Canada during the COVID-19 pandemic, spurred to a large extent by public health requirements on physical distancing. So we can't have 100 people sitting at 100 desks typing 100 computers hoping that they get Hamlet. What we have to have is 30 people sitting in a space with 100 desks, typing away with a 30% chance of typing Hamlet. I mean, that's what you kind of end up with. Companies often said they did this because they wanted to promote more intensive contact between different departments, but the truth of the matter was it's to cut down on real estate cost. No kidding. We put you all in a big room together so that you'd get to know each other better. No, no. We know why you're doing it. It's so you can convert floor 15, 16, and 17 into condos, into apartments. Now, wait a minute. TJ expressed a little concern a few minutes ago about the whole everything's in the one building that you're in. If you had to work remote, you'd only have to take the elevator upstairs. So you'd be in your own space, technically. What about that? No. See, that's people don't want to live and work and work and live all in the same space. That's what it comes down to. And I can say, I can tell you this with near biblical certitude. Teachers do not want to be living in the building where the students are living. That you don't need. And I can promise you that if your kids are bad, the parents don't want to be living in the building where the teachers are. Hey, you know, Mr. Miller, your daughter the other day simultaneously flushed all the toilets in the big room with the computers, and it was really bad. It's just terrible. Hey, I want to give a shout out, pass along condolences, and give a shout out to somebody whom I didn't know, but whose work I've greatly admired. The town of Indian Trail, mourning the loss of its mayor, who passed away while serving his third term in office. The town government confirmed that Michael Alvarez, who'd been in office since 2011, had died Wednesday morning. He had battled cancer, which led to the loss of his right arm. In a Facebook post, North Carolina State Senator Todd Johnson confirmed his fight with cancer had come to an end. He ran for mayor because he wanted to make a difference and leave an impact on his community. That's according to Indian Trail's town government announcement. During his decade-spanning service, the town noted that he made helping others a priority. Alvarez could easily be reached by phone, call, email, Facebook, what have you. And beyond his mayoral duties, the town noted that he was a major supporter of local business, Union County Sheriff's Office, the VFW, American Legion, Boy Scouts, many other local groups. This is important because these are the sorts of people we want representing us in elected office. We don't want somebody who wants to be an emperor and who wants to be worshipped and who wants to be feared or whatever. This is a public servant. This is someone who felt the pull inside him to serve his community. And as I said, while I've not met him, didn't meet him or get to know him, I think that's what we need more of in our culture, in our country. Some call it servant leadership. I just call it being a great friend and politician who's looking to serve and solve problems and not score points. God bless Michael Alvarez and his family, including his wife and three children. I'm Brett Winterble, News Talk 1110-993 WBT. News Talk 1110-993 WBT. It's the Brett Winterble Show. President of the United States, Joseph Biden, is touting his agenda despite some setbacks. He's going to be taking questions from the press the first time for one of these this year. And I don't think he's had one of these for about 300 days. Our microphones are there. We join the president already in progress.
Earlier? Yes. But we're doing more now. We've gone from zero at-home tests a year ago to 375 million tests on the market in just this month. If you buy a test at a store, your insurance will reimburse you. On top of that, we're making 1 billion at-home tests available for you to order and be delivered to your home for free. Just visit covidtest.gov to know how to get that free test kit to your home. In addition, there are 20,000 sites where you can get tested in person for free now. And now we have more treatments that people can keep people out of the hospital than any other point in the pandemic, including life-saving antiviral pills. We purchased 20 million of these new Pfizer pills, more than any country in the world. The bottom line on COVID-19 is that we're in a better place than we've been and have been thus far, clearly better than a year ago. We're not going back to lockdowns. We're not going back to closing schools. Schools should stay open because the American Rescue Plan, we provided the states $130 billion to keep our students and educators safe and schools open. funding for ventilation systems in schools, social distancing, hygiene for classrooms and the school buses. In addition, we've added another $10 billion for COVID-19 tests to be able to be administered at schools. And many states and school districts have spent this money very well. Unfortunately, some haven't. I encourage the states and school districts that use the funding to protect our children and keep our schools open. Use it. The COVID-19 is not going to give up and accept things. It's just not going to go away immediately. But I'm not going to give up and accept things as they are now. Some people may call what's happening now the new normal. I call it a job not yet finished. It will get better. We're moving toward a time when COVID-19 won't disrupt our daily lives, where COVID-19 won't be a crisis, but something to protect against and a threat. Look, we're not there yet, but we will get there. Now, the second challenge we're facing are prices. COVID-19 has created a lot of economic complications, including rapid price increases across the world economy. People see it at the gas pumps, the grocery stores, and elsewhere. So here's what we're going to do. A critical job in making sure that the elevated prices don't become entrenched rests with the Federal Reserve, which has a dual mandate, full employment and stable prices. The Federal Reserve provided extraordinary support during the crisis for the previous year and a half. Given the strength of our economy and the pace of recent price increases, it's appropriate, as the Federal Chairman Powell has indicated, to recalibrate the support that is now necessary. I respect the Fed's independence, and I've nominated five superb individuals to serve on the Federal Board of Governors, men and women from a variety of ideological perspectives. They're eminently qualified, historically diverse, and have earned bipartisan praise. I call on the United States Senate to confirm them without any further delay. And here at the White House, and for my friends in Congress, the best thing to tackle high prices is a more productive economy with greater capacity to deliver goods and services to the American people. And a growing economy where folks have more choices and more small businesses compete, and where more goods can get to market faster and cheaper. I've laid out a three-part plan to do just that. First, fix the supply chain. COVID-19 has had a global impact on the economy. When a factory shuts down in one part of the world, shipments to shops and homes and businesses all over the world are disrupted. COVID-19 has compounded that many times over. A couple of months ago, in this very room, we heard dire warnings about how the supply chain problems could create a real crisis around the holidays. So we acted. We brought together business and labor, and that much predicted crisis did not occur. 99% of the packages were delivered on time, and shelves were stocked. And notwithstanding the recent storms that have impacted many parts of our country, the share of goods in stock at stores is 89% now, which has barely changed from the 91% before the pandemic. I often see empty shelves being shown on television. 89% are full, which is only a few points below what it was before the pandemic. But our work's not done. My infrastructure law will supercharge your effort upgrading everything from roads and bridges to ports and airports, railways and transit, to make the economy move faster and reduce prices for families. Second thing, my Build Back Better plan will address the biggest cost of working families face every day. No other plan will do more to lower the cost for American families. It cuts the cost for childcare. Many families, including the people sitting in this room, if they have children and they're working full-time, many families pay up to $14,000 a year for childcare in big cities, less than that in smaller ones. My plan cuts that in half. That will not only be a game changer for so many families' budgets, but it will mean so much for the nearly 2 million women who've left the workforce during the pandemic because of things like childcare. My Build Back Better plan cuts the price of prescription drugs, so insulin, that today costs some people as much as $1,000 a month will cost no more than $35 a month. It cuts the cost of elder care. It lowers energy costs. And it will do all this without raising a single penny in taxes on people making under $400,000 a year or raising the deficit. In fact, my plan cuts the deficit and boosts the economy by getting more people into the workforce. That's why 17 Nobel Prize winners for economics say it will ease long-term inflationary pressure. The bottom line, if price increases are what you're worried about, the best answer is my Build Back Better plan. Third thing we're going to do, promote competition. Look, in too many industries, a handful of giant companies dominate the market in sectors like meat processing, railroad, shipping, and other areas. This isn't a new issue. It's not been the reason we've had high inflation today. It's not the only reason. It's been happening for a decade. But over time, it has reduced competition, squeezed out small businesses and farmers, ranchers, and increased the price for consumers. We end up with an industry like the meat processing industry, where four big companies dominate the markets. Pay ranchers less for their cattle they grow, charge consumers more for beef, hamburger meat, whatever they're buying. Prices are up. Look, I'm a capitalist, but capitalism without competition is not capitalism. It's exploitation. So I signed an executive order to tackle unfair competition in our economy, and we're going to continue to enforce it, along with working with Congress where we can. I'll close with this. We have faced some of the biggest challenges that we've ever faced in this country these past few years. Challenges to our public health, challenges to our economy. But we're getting through it. And not only are we getting through it, we're laying the foundation for a future where America wins the 21st century by creating jobs at a record pace. Now we need to get inflation under control. We have developed an extraordinarily effective booster shots and antiviral pills. Now we need to finish the job to get COVID-19 under control.
And we are going to rejoin the president in progress. Let's head on over to Boomer Von Cannon for a look at the roads. Boomer. All right, we are going back to the press conference at the White House. President Biden is speaking at the White House answering questions.
To get some of these big legislative ticket items done.
I got two real big ones done, bigger than any president has ever gotten in the first year.
But currently, Mr. President, your spending package, voting rights legislation, they're not going anywhere. So
that's true.
Is there anything that you are confident you can get signed into law before the midterm elections?
Yes, I'm confident we can get pieces, big chunks of the Build Back Better law signed into law. And I'm confident that we can take the case to the American people that the people they should be voting for who are going to oversee whether the elections, in fact, are legit or not, should not be those who are being put up by the Republicans to determine that they're going to be able to change the outcome of the election. So whether or not we can actually get election. And by the way, I haven't given up. We haven't finished the vote yet on what's going on voting rights and the John Lewis bill and others. But I've been engaged a long time in public policy, and I don't know many things that have been done in one fell swoop. And so I think the most important thing to do is try to inform, not educate, inform the public of what's at stake in stark terms and let them make judgments and let them know who's for them and who's against them, who's there and who's not there, and make that the case. And that's what I'm going to be spending my time doing in this off-year election.
Very quickly, you mentioned Republicans and reaching out to them. Some Republicans who may be open to major changes on voting rights, for instance, like Mitt Romney, he says he never even received a phone call from this White House. Why not?
I like Mitt. Look, Mitt Romney's a straight guy. One of the things that we're doing, I was trying to make sure we got everybody on the same page in my party on this score. And I didn't call many Republicans at all. The fact is that I do think that Mitt is a serious guy. I think we can get things done. I think I predict to you they'll get something done on the electoral reform side of this. But Rather than judge what's going to get done and not get done, all I can say is I'm going to continue to make the case why it's so important to not turn the electoral process over to political persons who were set up deliberately to change the outcome of elections. Allison Harris, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. Speaking of voting rights legislation, if this isn't passed, do you still believe the upcoming election will be fairly conducted and its results will be legitimate?
Well, it all depends on whether or not we're able to make the case to the American people that some of this is being set up to try to alter the outcome of the election. And it's one thing, look, maybe I'm just being too much of an optimist. Remember how we thought not that many people were going to show up to vote in the middle of a pandemic? We had the highest voter turnout in the history of the United States of America. Well, I think if, in fact, no matter how hard they make it for minorities to vote, I think you're going to see them willing to stand in line and defy the attempt to keep them from being able to vote. I think you're going to see the people we're trying to keep from being able to show up, showing up and making the sacrifice it needs to be made in order to change the law back to what it should be. But it's going to be difficult. I make no bones about that. It's going to be difficult. But we're not there yet. We've not run out of options yet. And we'll see how this moves.
And on Omicron and education, teachers are in revolt in so many places. Parents are at odds over closing schools and remote learning. You say we're not going to go back to closing schools. You said that just moments ago. Yet they're closing in some areas. What do you say to those teachers and principals and parents about school closings? And what can your administration do to help make up for learning loss for students?
First of all, I put in perspective the question you asked. Very few schools are closing. Over 95% are still open. So you all phrase the questions when people, I don't think it's deliberate on your part, but you phrase the question when anybody watches this on television. My God, there must be, all those schools must be closing. What are we going to do? 95% are still open, number one. Number two, the idea that parents don't think it's important for their children to be in school, and teachers know it as well. That's why we made sure that we had the ability to provide the funding through the Recovery Act, through the act that we, the first act we passed, to be able to make sure schools were able to be safe. So we have new ventilation systems available for them. We have the way they handle, they scrub down laboratories and the laboratories kids go to the bathroom, cafeterias, buses, et cetera. All that money's there. There's billions of dollars made available. It's there. Not every school district has used it as well as it should be used, but it's there. And so in addition to that, there is now another $10 billion for testing of students in the schools. So I think as time goes on, it's much more likely you're going to see that number go back up from 95% back up to 98%, 99%. But the outfit, the individuals of the district that says we're not going to be open is always going to get, and I'm not being critical of any of you, it's always going to get front page. It's always going to be the top of the news. But let's put it in perspective. 95, as high as 98% of the schools in America are open, functioning, and capable of doing the job.
All right, we're going to jump out and get an update from Anna Eric. News Talk 1110 and 99.3 WBT. It is the Brett Witterbull Show. Right, I'm going to go in for just a little bit more from the present. Not a lot of new ground has been plowed, folks. It's been a lot of the usual sort of hits, but let's hear what he's talking about here.
Not the major allies in the West would vote to bring Ukraine in right now. So there's room to work if he wants to do that. But I think, as usual, he's going to, well, I probably shouldn't go any further, but okay. I think it will hurt him badly.
It sounds like you're offering some way out here, some off-ramp. And it sounds like what it is at least an informal assurance that NATO is not going to take in Ukraine anytime in the next few decades. And it sounds like you're saying we would never put nuclear weapons there. He also wants us to move all of our nuclear weapons out of Europe and not have troops rotating through the old Soviet bloc. Do you think there's space for that there?
No. No, there's not space for that. We won't permanently station, but the idea we're going to actually increase troop presence in Poland or Romania, et cetera, if in fact he moves, because we have a sacred obligation in Article 5 to defend those countries. They are part of NATO. We don't have that obligation relative to Ukraine, although we have great concern about what happens in Ukraine. Thank you. Maureen, USA Today.
Thank you, Mr. President. I wanted to follow up on your comment on Build Back Better and also ask you a question about the pandemic. You said that you're confident you can pass big chunks of Build Back Better this year. Does that wording mean that you are thinking about, you're looking at breaking the package up into individual portions? And then on the pandemic, now that the Supreme Court has blocked the vaccination or test rule for larger businesses, are you reconsidering whether to require vaccines for domestic flights as a way to boost vaccination rates?
First of all, on the last part of the question, the Supreme Court decision, I think, was a mistake, but you still see thousands and thousands of people who work for major corporations having to be tested as a consequence of the decision made by the corporation, not by the standard ISET that is there. I think you'll see that increase, not decrease, number one. What was the first part of your question?
On your comment that you made that you're confident that major chunks of Build Back Better can pass, are you breaking it up?
It's clear to me that that we're going to have to probably break it up. I think that we can get, and I've been talking to a number of my colleagues on the Hill, I think it's clear that we would be able to get support for the $500+ billion for energy and the environmental issues that are there, number one. Number two, I know that the two people who've opposed, on the Democratic side at least, support a number of the things that are in there. For example, Joe Manchin strongly supports early education, 3 and 4 years of age, strongly supports that. There is strong support for, I think, a number of the way in which to pay for these, pay for this proposal. So I think there is, I'm not going to negotiate against myself as to what should and shouldn't be in it, but I think we can break the package up, get as much as we can now, and come back and fight for the rest later.
Okay, I'm gonna jump out of this. We've done 25, 30 minutes of the president and this press conference. We're going round and round in circles. It's the same thing over and over again. And it's no disrespect to the president, but he's got a limited message that he's going to continue to try to push. This has been a weak outing. As we speak, Joe Manchin is speaking on the floor of the United States Senate, addressing the objections that he has to blowing up the filibuster. So you've got this sort of back and forth happening at the exact same time. The Senate's not paying attention to this conference, this press conference. The press is paying attention to it. And in addition to that, I'd note a couple of things that I think are important to note. Joe Biden, President Biden, acknowledged it's true when a reporter said Build Back Better and voting rights bills aren't going to be going anywhere. Now, the fact that he would acknowledge that, I think, is it's a blunder. Also, he said in talking about Russia and Ukraine, he said eventually Russia would beat Ukraine. They'll be able to prevail over time, but it's going to be heavy losses. That's not rhetoric. I think I want to hear from the president. I mean, I know it's America standing strong, but are we going to go deploy 100,000 troops into Ukraine to take on the Russians? So he opens the entirety of the press conference with a pitch for Build Back Better, and he gets defensive about the COVID-19. There's not a lot from this. He went more than 12 minutes into the press conference without taking any questions. He gave a speech. Now he's answering questions based on the speech he gave My guess is his numbers will continue to drop as a result of this and what's going on in the Senate. That's my supposition right now. It's not that I expect this is exactly what we expected that we were going to get from him, which was just not a lot of meat on that bone. And he was very defensive in his first 12 minutes. News Talk 1110 993 WBT. See, we're vegan friendly. That's corn. 704-570-1110, News Talk 1110-993-WBT. All right, let me jump out of the phones and get reaction on this presser that we've been watching. We begin with J.D. Hey, J.D., how are you?
Brett, I'm telling you, this is the worst news conference I've ever seen.
It's unreal.
Bumbling, babbling, blaming this, blaming that, lie after lie after lie. He even says he did a good job with his report card. Mr. President, your report card? Inflation is that high. I don't care how you say, oh, the employment is at 3.9%. Yeah. Let's put all the billions of people that are out of work and put that and add that into the 3.9%. I guarantee you probably see something over 11%. This is saying about Russia, oh, if they come into Russia, if Russia goes into Ukraine, there's going to be a lot of people. And it's going to,
right.
What are you signaling there, Mr. President? You're sitting there, we just with Afghanistan, you sat there and said the Taliban or Taliban aren't going to do anything. The Taliban aren't going to do anything. The Taliban aren't going to do anything. But yet, the Taliban took over Kabul and we lost 13 soldiers. Another thing?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, another thing with the voting rights bill?
Mm-hmm.
To all these people attacking cinema and Manchin and all that, I say bring it on. Keep on harassing them. Keep on harassing them because you know what? Manchin and cinema will flip. They will flip to the Republicans. And the Republicans will have the Senate again. That means we can investigate Fauci. That means we can investigate where this came from,
right.
Where this coronavirus came from. That means we could go and you subpoena Nancy Pelosi's files to see if she knew anything about the Capitol riot. This is their only play right now is the Capitol riot thing right now. Another thing.
Yes.
Why haven't I heard one question about, Mr. President, are you going to get tough with these district attorneys that are...
No! Those are his guys. That's his linebacking
corps.
Out
of control.
No, he's not going to do
it. Where are we just lost a 24-year-old girl in
yes, we did.
Los Angeles trying to achieve her dreams. But guess what? She was stabbed by a homeless person that had a rap sheet as long as my arm.
That's right. That's right.
What
listen.
What is he doing out of jail? What is he doing out
well,
of jail?
Well, they caught him. They caught him today, but I get the point there, JD. I appreciate you being out there, man. Look, he's got a lot of passion in this regard. Pramila Jayapal, who's one of the antagonists of people like Sinema and Manchin. Let me get this straight. We only need 51 votes to pass tax cuts for the wealthy, but 60 to protect voting rights and save our democracy. Actually, that's not accurate there, Senator. You need 60 to close debate on the tax cuts and then 51 to pass the tax cuts. That's how you do it. It's the way you stop debate. You know, tyranny of the majority is not going to be tolerated by people in this country, no matter how you spin it. It's just not right. Is Manchin still talking? Is he still on the floor of the Senate?
It's not Manchin.
It's not Manchin anymore? Okay, he finished talking. He was talking while the president was talking, which is actually kind of interesting because that's signaling that the Senate is going to continue to just do their thing. The Senate is going to march on while this president is having his press conference and his press briefing. I didn't hear any sort of sense from this president that he was able to bridge a divide. They asked him directly, you work with any Republican? Are there any Republicans that you work with? He's like, oh, Mitt Romney's a nice guy. But there's no movement on any of this. There's no movement on this. And so what are we looking at right now? Here's what we're looking at right now. We're looking at a situation where this president has taken two enormous bills, the voting bills, there's two of them, and this Build Back Better bill. And he announced he was going to put these through, not knowing whether or not he had enough cachet as president to sway this. The answer is he didn't. He didn't. And one only has to go back in time, only go back a little bit in time, to look at a letter that was sent to Mitch McConnell on April the 7th, 2016, 30 Democrats sent that letter in a bipartisan fashion to Mitch McConnell asking him to keep the filibuster. Chris Coons, Joe Manchin, a number of these folks, 30 of them wrote to Mitch McConnell and said, please keep the filibuster in place in 2016 when he threatened to blow up the filibuster. Now everything is reversed. The shoe is on the other foot. And now the Democrats are furious and they're saying they won't endorse or support Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. It's a big mistake. Kyrsten Sinema is a reliably progressive vote in the Senate for the Democrats. She just doesn't want to blow up the filibuster. And Joe Manchin, that's not a threat that's going to really harm him because he's carrying the torch for the people who are in his state. That state went 69% for Trump. So the Democrats cutting off Joe Manchin is a whole lot like the governor of Vermont calling WBT and telling them to turn me off. It's going to be like, well, that's fine in Vermont, but we're not in Vermont, Mr. Governor. I'm sorry to tell you that. We're not going to turn it off. The fact is, the president needs a better quarterback in that White House helping him move this legislation. That's what he needs. He doesn't have a tactician. He doesn't have a field general, doesn't have an offensive coordinator, has an offensive coordinator, but not an offensive coordinator. And it's up to him to be able to move this legislation through. I thought Schumer was like this experienced old hand. I thought he knew how to move legislation. It seems to me that all he knows how to do is stand on the floor of the Senate, pound the podium, and lament and yell and cry and not deliver the goods. I mean, what's going on here? How does this work? Another great hour straight ahead, taking your phone calls and reactions to this press conference and everything else that's moving today. News Talk 1110 and 99.3 WBT. News Talk 1110 and 99.3 WBT. It is the Brett Winterble Show, 704-570-1110. Later this hour, Bo Thompson comes by. We'll cross the streams. And much later this hour, Mark Garrison comes by and we preview Charlotte at 6, get a sense of what it is that's happening out there. So the president's press conference is continuing to go. He's got immense stamina, I guess, here today because he started at 4 o'clock and it's 5:05 and change. And he's continuing to answer these questions. Not a lot was gained from this, okay? Tomorrow is the one-year anniversary, and with an eye towards tomorrow, I did ask a question earlier in the program, which was, okay, as you assess this presidency of this president, what's your biggest disappointment or biggest surprise from this year? Afghanistan, COVID-19, the economy, inflation, the border, crime, what have you. Do any of those rise to the level of scandal in your mind? And if you were in that room right now and you had the opportunity to ask the president a question, what would you want to ask him about? What topic would you ask him about? Now, these are not minor things. We have to understand the government is not the president. The president, as we all well know, or many of us well know from civics, the president is the head of the executive branch. But it's up to the Senate and it's up to the Congress to do the things that they do. And it's up to our state houses to do the things that they're going to do. And the reality is, as much as stuff is being driven from Washington at a given point, a lot of the issues that we're being plagued by, crime in the streets, inflation, border security, and of course, supply chain issues, many of those issues are connected in their own way to specific parts of the country. More likely than not, where you live, you may not be experiencing a horrible crime surge. You may not be experiencing something that is the border crisis. You may be experiencing inflation, no doubt. You may be experiencing issues with the supply chain, no doubt. COVID-19, without a doubt. And you may still be very upset about Afghanistan. But these are issues that when they emerge or refuse to go away like COVID-19, These are issues that this president has to answer the questions on, because it's not going to be Chuck Schumer. Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell are going to sit there and say, hey, we spent $4.5 trillion this year, this past year, just wrapped, to fund pandemic money and vaccines and relief and schools and all that kind of stuff. So we did what we had to do. You signed it into law, Mr. President. The rest of it's kind of on you. You can't go and talk to a congressman or a senator and say, okay, so what's the story with the testing kits? And testing kits have been ordered. What's the story with the masks? The masks have been ordered from China, like the testing kits are coming from China. So there's a limit by which you can really kind of point at the president and say, ah, you've made all of this miserable. What he has done, and JD asked this question in the last hour, and I think it's a spot-on question, where's the commentary from this president on crime? Rampant crime. Deadly crime. And predominantly, when you see the coverage of what's happening, it's crimes against women. It's crimes against women. Ms. Kupfer there in Los Angeles. You had a nurse murdered in broad daylight at 9 o'clock in the morning in Los Angeles. She was on her way to work as an emergency room nurse, was waiting for the bus, and a derelict ran up on her and killed her in broad daylight. You have constant episodes of people being pushed in front of subway cars in New York City. And overwhelmingly, the victims are females. The party of Me Too, the party of women's rights, the party of doesn't have a whole lot to say about it. And overwhelmingly, the district attorneys in these communities are men. Gascon, Chesa Boudin, Alvin Bragg in New York. They're men who don't seem to be giving any particular special concern to the women that are losing their lives going to work and at work. Now, what can the president say about that? The president could probably say, I want to make myself clear. I don't support what these district attorneys are doing around the country in weakening the efforts of law enforcement to provide for safe communities for women, children, and men and taxpayers. No, that's not the case at all. I mean, I don't know if any of you saw that opening 20 minutes last night on Tucker Carlson's program. I watched it. I didn't record it. I'm not going to play it for you. But he went into immense depth and detail as to how it is our great cities, and thank God, by the way, Charlotte is not counted among the cities that are suffering this sort of blight that we're seeing in New York and in Los Angeles and in San Francisco and in Portland and in Baltimore and in cities across this country. You are seeing the death of the great cities in this country because turf has been surrendered. Now, that deserves its own address. That deserves its own efforts from the president of the United States. What are you doing to make people feel safer? 29 people shot in Chicago this past weekend during a blizzard. And while we're at it, it's not the fault of the gun. It's the fault of the criminal. Nobody ever looked around their neighborhood and said, oh boy, I'm so glad there's just no cops around or anything, or nobody's patrolling, and grandma might be victim. I'm just so glad we have so many people that are looking to break the law right in the neighborhood. It's nice. That's a good way to live. Nobody ever said that. Nobody ever said, I wish we had more drug dealers. Nobody said, I wish we had more gangs walking around. I wish we had more muggers. I wish we had more addicts. I wish we had more alcoholics laying in the street. I wish we had more vandalism. We had more tagging. Nobody ever said, this used to be a really bad neighborhood until the social justice district attorney got elected and let everybody kind of do their own thing. You just may not want to step outside while they're doing their own thing to your thing. News Talk 1110-993 WBT. It's the Brett Winterville Show alongside my good friend, Bo Thompson, as we cross the streams. Good afternoon, Bo Thompson. Good to have you back.
Hey, good afternoon. Good to be here.
It's interesting. I'm sitting here, and I was going to say, what did you think of the Biden presser? But he's continuing to talk. We went out at about 4:45 from this, but he's continuing to answer questions. He's now an hour and 20 minutes into this this press conference. Have you noted anything about it or picked up anything from it?
I haven't been able to watch a whole lot of it, just because of things I got going on this afternoon.
Sure.
I've gone in and out of it. I do think that by the time we get to the end of this, it may this press conference may add up to longer than all the other ones combined.
That's a really good point. I'm wondering if he's maybe trying to do an endurance kind of a thing. Like, oh, you know what? I had 2 5-hours. Let's just let this thing roll for as long as we can.
Well, you know, I mean, it's... Look, somebody's obviously in his ear saying that he needs to do this more. I guess the question ends up being, is this a trend or is this a one-off? You know, I was looking at the numbers on this, and he has held the fewest number of news conferences by a president in the first year since Ronald Reagan. And you and I both know Reagan was famous for the number of press conferences that he didn't do.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think Reagan was much more effective at, he may be the best president we've ever had that could make the most out of a small amount of time. And when he had his moments,
right,
he made the most of them and was a very effective speaker when he chose his spots. You know, Biden, I think most people would say, he doesn't choose his spots very well, and when he does choose them, they usually don't go very well. So maybe he's coming out of the gate this year with someone in his ear saying, you've got to be more accessible, which I would think would be good advice.
See, to me, this feels like it's, and I'm not trying to nitpick, but to me, it feels like it's 3 weeks too late. Like, this is the thing you do at the end of the year, right? I mean, kind of like to wrap it up and look back. And then there's a natural re-beginning when you get to the new year. But what he's doing is he's using the clock based on his presidency rather than the calendar year.
Well, and to your point, most presidents do their State of the Union addresses in January or February, not March.
Right, which is weird. I mean, it's very strange that we're just kind of moving the clocks around here and all of this. What do you make of this? Because, I mean, you're an astute viewer of things that are political. While he's speaking at 4:30, Joe Manchin was speaking and was making a pretty aggressive case, not rude or anything over the top, but an aggressive case in which he's saying never in history has a minority been able to kill a filibuster or kill a bill. It's always going to take a majority of people to do this. This is why you have to have cloture and 60 votes to end debate before you proceed to the passage. Interesting to see that the wheels of the Senate kept turning while the president was answering questions from the press.
Well, again, and you and I sort of alluded to this a few times over the last week about Joe Biden entered the White House with the resume of the guy that, one of the old war horses of the Senate, the guy who had been there so long he knew the place back and forward. And if I were Joe Biden, I would sort of be cognizant of what, one thing Trump did really well, and still does well, is sort of knows how to read the landscape of the media.
Right.
Even recently, I mean, we usually talk about President Trump, speeches that he does make. He realized that January 6th was not going to be necessarily the best backdrop for him to make his case. That's the most recent thing we can think of. But during his presidency, he knew, and this is a lot because of his media background, but he knew how to use the media. To your point, Biden's sitting here speaking at the same time when not only is Senate business going on, but senators are free to make their points at the same time. And a 4 o'clock afternoon speech is much different than a primetime speech. Or,
sure is.
And I know that this is a media age where, conventions, for example, aren't carried the way they used to be carried, but
that's right.
You still, as the President of the United States, have the ability, Democrat or Republican, to carve out media coverage when you really want to. You just got to use it effectively.
So let me pivot you over to where news and culture and sports meet up. Turns out this decision over in Australia about Novak Djokovic has apparently blown up in the face of the government. People are really mad about Australia sending him back to Serbia.
Well, I mean, it's through a lot of different, there are a lot of layers to it, right? There's the sports fan who wanted to see Novak compete because he's number one in the world.
Right.
There's the not necessarily a tennis fan or maybe a passing tennis fan that looks at this and says, well, how is the guy, you know, the treatment of Djokovic while he was waiting for this to happen? That's another source for concern amongst fans. And, you know, now you're hearing that perhaps he could be in danger of not playing in the French Open because of ordinance that they've enacted there. But it's interesting. I think the electorate or a lot of the public there seems to be, as you say, starting to swing the pendulum over towards Novak. Some of the players are starting to be outspoken at this point. And I've heard more players praising what the government did than not praising it, which I think is interesting. Eventually here you're going to have somebody who's going to be the go against the grain, and I wonder who that'll be.
Yeah, that's going to be the big question. And finally, question for you is, are you surprised at how quiet ESPN has been relative to the Chamath Palihapitiya comments about, I don't care about the Uyghurs, it's not an issue that rises up to my level? You surprised that ESPN's been quiet about it?
No, I'm not surprised. I would not expect them to go all in on covering this until they absolutely have to. It's the same reason why we talked and have talked a little bit about the dicey situation that NBC has going into the Olympics coverage with all the money that's riding on this for them and the obvious human rights issues that are going on in China. And we're hearing about how the media is starting to give signs there, or should I say the government there is starting to float warning signs that they may try to stifle what the press says about the Olympics coverage of not just the games but of what's going on in the country. I think it's very much the same thing NBC is dealing with, ESPN is dealing with. You've got to be careful, or I believe they think they've got to be careful not to have this turn into something huge and overshadow the events. But whether or not they'll be able to do that much longer, I don't know.
All right, and finally, tomorrow is Thursday by my count on my calendar, which means it may be snowy Friday Eve. What do we got coming up?
You know how this works now, man.
Yes.
Every day, Ray Stajic has been my standby from the Weather Channel, and he'll be back tomorrow, and we'll talk about how this it comes into focus. We get a little closer to Friday. What I'm starting to hear, as I know you are a little bit, is maybe they're drawing back a little bit on the amount we could get, and perhaps the overarching thing I've heard this afternoon, and obviously Ray will update us with the latest tomorrow morning, is this is not going to be the size of an event as what we saw on Sunday.
So you're saying there's no guarantee school might be canceled on Friday?
I'm not guaranteeing anything, but I'll be on the air tomorrow talking to my meteorologist. That's what I'll guarantee.
You got it, man. Have a great night. Appreciate you being there, Bo.
You too. Talk to you.
That's right. News Talk 1110-993 WBT. News Talk 1110-993 WBT. It is the Brett Winterville Show. All right. TJ, let's go back. He's now into an hour 36. Are our mics still up there in the room? Let's see.
I spent a lot of time in South America and in Latin America. When I was vice president, I spent the bulk of my years basically in Europe and or in Latin America. I'm in contact with the leaders of the countries in South America. We're working closely with making sure that we do everything, for example, with the to deal with helping the countries in question, particularly those in Central America, to be able to help them with their ability to deal with the people don't sit around in Guatemala and say, I got a great idea. Let's sell everything we have, give the money to a coyote, take us across a terribly dangerous trip up through Central America.
They do it every day.
Mexico and sneak us across the border, drop us in the desert. Won't that be fun? People leave because they have real problems. And one of the things I've done when I was a vice president, got support with, although I don't have much Republican support anymore, is provide billions of dollars to be able to say to those countries, why are people leaving? And how are you going to reform your own system? And that's what we've worked on a long time. It still needs a lot more work, and we're focusing on that. I also believe I've spent a lot of time talking about and dealing with policy having to do with Maduro, who is
little more than a dictator right now. And the same thing in Chile and and not the same thing, but with Chile as well as Argentina. So, look, I made a speech a while ago when I was vice president saying that if we were smart, we have an opportunity to make the Western Hemisphere a a democratic hemisphere. And we were moving in the right direction under the last administration, the Obama-Biden administration. But so much damage was done as a consequence of the foreign policy decisions the last president made.
No, but you're president.
In Latin America, Central America, and South America.
Yeah.
That we now have, when I call for a summit of the democracies, I call that, and a number of nations showed up for this.
Oh, this is all nonsense. This is nonsense. First of all, the prior president, Donald Trump, struck a deal with Mexico to harness the power of the Mexican military and border patrol to stop people from coming across the country. And they would either remain in Mexico or be turned away at the southern border. That's actually a good working relationship between two countries, the United States and Mexico. Number two, he told the old story that has no root in reality. Nobody ever says, you know, it'd be really great living here in Guatemala. Let's sell all of our things and hire coyotes and take a trip across the dangerous Mexican countryside and come and sneak into the United States. Are you kidding me? People do it every single day. They're not doing it because they want to, Joe. They're doing it because they're desperate. And you leaving the border open encourages them to make that trip. When the border was shut under Trump, people weren't making the trip. During COVID-19, OG COVID-19, meaning in 2019 and 2020, back before we were Bidenized, that's right, the country has been Bidenized for the last year. Before we were Bidenized, Mr. President, you didn't have people crossing the borders because you had COVID-19 as a real issue, and you had a White House that was committed to securing the border. You just thought it was important to get in that bathtub and pull the plug just because you could. You and Hair Club for Men, Ron Klain. I mean, you guys just decided, let's just turn off the energy. Let's open the border. Let's encourage criminality and human smuggling and human trafficking. I thought you were the Me Too guys. I thought you were the people that wanted to protect women and children. You're probably... I mean, I remember once upon a time when the president that you served under was regarded by the gun manufacturers as somebody who was very effective at getting people to buy guns because he was scaring them all the time with the potential of a crackdown. You are very effective at getting people smuggled into the country. You may not want that to be the case, but by leaving the border wide open, you've got tons of fentanyl and you got tons of people getting snuck into the country. And oh, by the way, I don't know how many Afghanistan questions were asked, but I will tell you this because I saw the coverage last night. Do you know that there are many, many Afghan families who are stranded in Greenville, South Carolina, and Charlotte in motels? Afghans, refugees that we resettled here, and they're not giving them work permits or support. So veterans, American veterans who served in Afghanistan are having to try to get them support right here in Charlotte. Nobody's talking about that. Why is nobody talking about that? That they're only here because of what he did there. This guy's got a really bad foreign policy track record. Remember what Bob Gates said? Never write once in 50 years. In 50 years. You know what kind of streak that is? It's when you get Bidenized. Ladies and gentlemen, approaching the microphone.
Oh, he's already here.
For the third time this week. Mark Garrison, Charlotte at 6. Hello, Mark Garrison.
How are you?
I'm well. Are you stocking up with supplies for the coming storm?
Oh, you mean for this?
Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
Yes. Yeah, well, at 6:20, we will talk to the Weather Channel, but I would not go out and buy bread and milk for this one.
Oh, so you still got stuff left over from last week?
Well, that plus this one's not a bread and milk kind of snowstorm, apparently. It's more of a, who cares?
I hear you, man.
At least that's what we're hoping.
I'm always worried about the firewood and beef jerky kind of storms. You know what I'm saying? Honey, lay in some firewood and beef jerky.
Get the beef jerky.
What else you got coming up?
Well, we're going to lead off. It's a Dirty Book Wednesday on the show, and we're asking, why is CMS assigning a book that is full of the N-word and has a sex scene in it that sounds like something out of a cheap romance novel, and we're going to let you hear some of it.
Whoa!
Yeah.
A theatrical reading?
Actually, it's from the audio version of the book.
Oh, yeah. Gosh. Okay.
Yeah, cool. And our Brett Jensen is getting stonewalled by CMS looking for answers on, hey, why are you making kids read a dirty book? I mean, come on.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Can 5G phone service cause a jetliner to crash?
This is a scary new thing, and for whatever reason, it's just us that seems to be worried about this.
Yeah, 5G is rolling out today around the country, but not near airports such as Charlotte. Charlotte Airport is one of those that will not have 5G within a certain area of the airport until that question gets answered. We'll tell you more about that.
Wow.
Coming up at 6:35, you're going to love this story. A remarkable effort here in Charlotte to save a 9-year-old boy who has a very difficult cancer, and researchers here have come up with a custom vaccine just for him.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's really cool.
I'm stoked for that.
Yeah.
I'm stoked for the whole show, but really, that's a great way to wrap the show.
Yeah, it's a good one.
All right, my friend, we're looking forward to it.
Thanks, sir.
You're welcome. That's Mark Garrison, Charlotte at 6. You know, that's what's so cool, because while everything's like going on with politics and we're fighting and we're going back and forth on a number of issues, what really does matter is stuff like science and saving kids who have cancer, and that's we should never forget that that's the point of a lot of this. You know, we have our fights, we have our debates, we have all this stuff, but we have to also remember that it shouldn't take up like the entirety of our lives. I don't know anybody who watched this press conference, which is like still going on. He's wrapping up. You know, he's got his briefing book in his hand. I don't know anybody who's watched this and had their mind changed. I think they've had their positions kind of reinforced, but not really had their minds changed. And this is just kind of where we are in the country right now. And what's interesting to me is we're hearing about all these voter laws that have to be put through at the federal level because the election last time around wasn't secure, or the election coming up isn't secure. So which is it? Was the last election secure and this upcoming one's not? Or is it just this upcoming one is not secure because it's a midterm and you may have Nancy Pelosi, Her Royal Highness and company removed from office? What is the impetus for federalizing our elections? Has it gotten so risky that people will be voted out that we have to do something to make sure that that does not occur? And no one's going to give you an answer to that. No one's going to say to you, well, yes, we have to change these election laws because otherwise we won't be able to change these election laws. I just wish we got like a specific presentation from the president and from the vice president and from the speaker and from Chuck Schumer. And it wasn't just get rid of the filibuster. Don't get rid of the filibuster. Why don't you put up a chart that has all the elements in this? Because I know some of the elements that are in it that are kind of weird that most Americans probably wouldn't want to vote for, which is one of them is paying a salary to candidates who are running for office. Why? Did Abe Lincoln get a salary when he ran for the Congress or ran for the Senate or ran for the presidency? No. No, he didn't. And that's sort of the point of this, right? It's sort of the point of all this. If you want to run for office, run for office. Nobody's stopping you. Anybody can run for any office they want. Go back to that election we just had in 2021 in New Jersey. The Senate president in the state of New Jersey is taken out by a truck driver. The governor almost lost. That just means that people were fed up with who was in office. The truck driver didn't need to get a salary to run for the position. Did he? Do you? I know a lot of people are going to sign up and become professional candidates so they can get on the DOLE dole. I know that's the case. I know that that's what's going to happen. If you pay people to do things, they're going to do those things that you're paying them to do. If you pay them not to work, they're going to not work. If you pay them so that they can stay home and smoke weed and drink alcohol, they're going to take the money and sit home and smoke weed and drink alcohol. If you subsidize something, you get more of it. If you tax something, you get less of it. That's a basic rule in life. And we're taught, and we hear constantly from politicians, Republicans and Democrats, that this is it. It's over. We're doomed. Forget it. We're not doomed. It's clear what's going to happen in this upcoming election. It's why Joe Biden came out and did an hour and 45 minute press conference in the middle of the day. He could have done this at 8 o'clock at night, 9 o'clock at night. Obama did it. Reagan did it. Clinton did it. Bush did it. Bush did it. Nixon did it. People did nighttime press conferences so that people could see this and digest this. If you're doing it at 4 o'clock in the afternoon when it's 1 o'clock on the West Coast, it means a lot of people are only going to see the highlights handpicked and selected by news editors in liberal newsrooms where they're going to get the content that is intended and not the full picture of what was said. I encourage everybody to go back and watch it tonight. And especially the last 45 minutes. And you tell me that that was a high performance. You tell me that was a big performance. You tell me that that was somebody who's got a real plan moving forward. That story alone about leaving Guatemala or Honduras and the illegal immigrants and all that sort of stuff. The reality is there are people coming from 168 countries around the globe. Very few are coming from Honduras. But a lot are coming from Uzbekistan. Why? Ask yourself that question. That's going to do it for me. Thanks to TJ and Josh and Anna and Mark and Boomer and Bo. I'm Brett Witterbull. We'll do it again tomorrow starting at 3. News Talk 1110, 99.3 WBT.